welcome to Forward. I'm your host, Allison Innes. Today I'd like to introduce you to one of our music grads. I first met Nick Cooper while he was still a busy undergraduate student here at Brock, playing in various bands and ensembles. Nick graduated from Brock with a Bachelor of Music degree in 2017, and since then, his music career has taken him around the globe and back again. And I just learned recently that he's just finished releasing his first solo album. I caught up with Nick to ask him about his time at Brock, his experiences since graduating, and what he's up to now. Sit back and enjoy our conversation.
All right. Well, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I remember you and I first spoke, I think, when I just started working in the Faculty of Humanities, and you were still an undergrad student. I think you were maybe in your fourth year, and you had just had been on a really interesting adventure playing in an orchestra in Sicily, I think. You were playing oboe?
That's right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So if I can take you back to, that would have been in 2016, 2017?
That's right.
Around then? All right. So if I can take you back to your student days, and we'll kind of start there, start our conversation there. What was it like being a music student here at Brock, and what kind of adventures did you get up to?
Sure, absolutely. I would have graduated university in 2017, which means that I would have started in September 2013. And I got kind of the best of both worlds, I think, because when I first started, it was still part of the main campus. In my second year, they'd announced that they would be opening the Marilyn I. Walker, and then I literally got half and half. I got the other half in Marilyn I. Walker. And I say the best of both worlds because there was, although it was a relatively small area that was sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, designated to the music department, my theory is that created a kind of closeness, a tight-knit community of musicians and music students and faculty. I'd finished high school. I was the only one in my year in high school that had graduated and decided to pursue music post-secondary, the only one out of probably around 100 students. And so I felt like I was finally swimming in the waters I should have been swimming in the whole time. I finally met people who wanted to pursue music not just for fun, but because, you know, it meant so much to them as well. And those were sort of my first impression. There are so many, but my first impression really was that I was finally where I longed to be. It's finally where I meant to be, among people who cared about music as much as I did, who loved music as much as I did. And that I had professors in all subjects that were they just inspired me so much. And it kept the fire lit in me until the very end. Yeah.
That's fantastic to hear. So as a high school student, when you were looking at programs, what was it about Brock and the music program? Like, were you local to St. Catharines? Did you come from further away? And what attracted you to come here or to stay here, as the case might be?
Right. So I am a Niagara local originally. I grew up in Niagara Falls, which is, it was always 20 minutes away to get to Brock before they moved downtown. And it was always a bus ride away. So that was, of course, a factor. But, you know, you grow up in the same place and part of you wants to, your feet want to move. You sort of want to try something new and start a new chapter. So there was, of course, a beckoning within me to try to go somewhere else and do something completely out of left field. So I did audition at a few other universities for music, and some of them had, you know, renowned programs and whatnot. But the thing that really changed my mind, the thing that helped me make up my mind, I should say, because I wasn't dead set on any one. In fact, it was a very difficult decision. And maybe someone listening to the podcast at the moment is going from grade 12 to university and they're trying to struggle with the decision as well. And I feel you. It's very, very difficult, especially if you've got a few options in front of you. I, of course, had sort of run down the list of the pros and cons of each one, and still I couldn't flip a coin and decide. The thing that really brought me to Brock was my oboe professor. His name is Colin Meyer. And it was the chair at the time, she's still the chair of the music department, Dr. Karen DeBella, had found Colin because she had noticed that in her potential, you know, upcoming year, there was an oboist coming and they had no oboe teacher. So she found Colin, and I remember I had some emails back and forth with some of the oboe professors at the other schools, nothing extraordinary, but Colin reached out and we had maybe a 3-hour conversation over the phone, complete strangers, talking everything oboe, all of my questions, concerns. He answered everything. And still to this day, if I'm an open-minded musician, it's because of him. If I am able to approach a musical situation, any musical context, without any rigidity, with an open mind, it's because of his approach. And really, Colin was the deciding factor for me, knowing that I had such an amazing professor, someone so attentive, someone who would hear me out. And that is, of course, an extension of overall, again, Dr. K's ability to find the best person for the job, and having that flexibility on the department side was ultimately what brought me to Brock.
So when you come into a music program, like, is that the only instrument you study, or do you have to learn other instruments along the way? Are you learning from other professors as well as your oboe instructor? Like, how does it work?
Well, that's a wonderful question. So you've got your lessons one-on-one with your teacher an hour a week. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe the music program still has it. They just introduced it in my third year. It was a performance stream. There's an education stream, a musicology or a theory stream, but now there's a performance stream. That if you qualify, you get a little bit more time with your professor every week. I think it maybe goes up to 2 hours a week or something like that, or maybe even more. It might have changed. But one thing that, again, to go back to my theme of how Brock helped me in so many different regards, is that because it's such a tight-knit program, there's so much focus, not just on the individual student, but on the individual classes and everything that's going on. You as a student have, the sky's the limit. The opportunity is there for you, and the support is there, because again, you're surrounded by students who are like-minded and staff who are running all of these different aspects of the program, whether it be wind ensemble or choir, jazz band. As an oboe student, if I want to sing in choir in most other universities, that is usually reserved for vocal majors, and usually it's packed. And unless I am doing a double major in vocal studies, or I'm just a phenomenal singer, odds are that place is taken. But I think the Brock Music Program's approach produces wonderfully well-rounded musicians, in that when, you know, if you want to go into performance, you've worn so many hats that, you know, you are a very viable professional. You can be implied in choir. You can run a choir if that's what you'd like to do. If you want to go into education, you've touched so many different aspects of being a musician, of loving music in general, of being a music educator or teacher or professor, that you bring that to everything that you do, and it's infectious. And so again, I feel that's something that Brock really, really has going for it, is that all of these options are really open to everyone. They're free to everyone. And in fact, choir was obligatory. Like, we had to be in choir, and it's the best thing you can do, because at the end of the day, it keeps coming back. I hear instrumentalists talking about how they're trying to mimic the voice, trying to sound like a vocalist. Everyone is trying to sound like a soprano or a tenor or a bass or a baritone, trying to find their voice on their instrument. Meanwhile.
All right. So what other instruments did you study in? So oboe was your main instrument. What other instruments did you delve into and develop a liking for, maybe? Or
so the oboe was not my first instrument, it was my last. My first instrument was the drums. I started when I was about 4 or 5 on the drums, and I've been playing in bands since I was a kid. I picked up the guitar in middle school sometime, and then the bass shortly after that, the piano when I was young as well, around the time I started the drums. So But I realized when I was finishing high school that I had to go to university for something, and there was no rock and roll program. I had to go, you know, and study something classically. And so that's why the oboe came through that way. But the love that I had for all kinds of other music outside of classical music, I was able to continue with all of that because, again, I was surrounded by so many new musicians and everyone wanted to start new projects. And I was part of a band that formed in my first year and we played for years. We were a 7-piece funk band and we had the time of our lives playing, and that was outside of school. So again, there's something to be said about the connections that you, of course, it's all really all about that, is the people that you come to know, you get friend, you become friends with, and you get to know, I should say. And then, you know, you make music together and that lasts forever. So those other instruments were all really done outside of class. But something that's been indispensable for me were the woodwind techniques and brass techniques courses, because I am now a full-time music and French teacher. And I can talk also about my experience in the French department at Brock as well. I would be happy to touch on that. Nothing really could have prepared me better for the myriad of questions that inevitably sprout up when you give a classroom full of eighth graders their first woodwind, brass, and percussion instruments to start a band. Then nothing can prepare you more. So I was really lucky to have those in my back pocket, and everything comes back super quickly. The courses were excellent. And then, of course, conducting techniques. But as far as the other instruments were concerned, again, it's sort of like in school or in university, you have your courses, which are centered towards your main instrument. You have choir. You have an ensemble outside of that that you can apply yourself in, whether that's wind ensemble or jazz band, or there's also the strings now. So for all the string players, there's a string orchestra, which is phenomenal. And so as far as mixing it up and going with other instruments, a lot of that you can reach out to the jazz band and say, hey, if you're looking for another rhythm section player on an off day, I would love to play bass. Or, you know, everyone's always looking for subs. And so, again, sort of working your way into the community very naturally, very easily through the program is a forte, I think, a really important aspect of it. And, you know, getting together with your friends after class or on the weekends to jam, to write, to compose, that's what it's all about, too, for sure.
So I do want to come back to studying French and now your perhaps bravery in teaching young children how to play instruments. But I want to get ask you about that Sicily trip and some of the opportunities that you had to travel and learn outside of the university.
Okay, so it really did all start with that. It was between my third and fourth years. In my third year, I performed a joint recital with a guitarist named Brody Smith, and it was 45 minutes for me and maybe an hour or so for Brody, if I'm not mistaken. With an intermission in between, we played Gabriel's Oboe as the finale. And anyway, my performance level had never been higher to that point. I memorized my program, which is something that Colin was really encouraging on, and he showed me so much because it's not mandatory, but it's helped me so much as a musician to practice that muscle, the memory capacity of learning music. But he also, my teacher that is, Colin, had recommended to me that over the course of the year, as I'm working on my repertoire, record myself, just turn my iPad camera on, and when I'm done my session, turn the camera on and play the last version of it, the best version you can at the end of that practice session. And, you know, there's no better teacher than that. You know, it's so awful hearing yourself and all of your, because in your head you can, it's sort of like you said at the beginning, you know, hearing your voice recorded back, some people just can't stand it. It's like, you know, nails on a chalkboard. When you hear yourself recorded back, there's no filter. There's really no buffer. So you hear everything. But, you know, that's exactly why you want to do it. And I understand his point now better than ever, is so that you can hear yourself, so that you can adjust. You can make those mental adjustments before you go back into practice next time, the following day or whatever. So over the year, I'd amassed this collection of snippets, of little recordings of different things that I'd been doing. The recital happens in March. I finish my exams in May or April, maybe early May. And I'd applied to this festival that was going to be happening all summer long from June until August. And I'd forgot about it because I thought, you know what, if this is open to everyone, why would I get it? I knew that I was working. It wasn't self-defeating. I just thought, you know, I just didn't want to get my hopes up, I think, is really, I was just sort of hedging my bets. And so I'm eating a bowl of cereal one morning and I get an email from the director, the coordinator of the festival, the founder, saying, we've had an emergency oboe situation. Our oboist that we've selected has pulled out. Basically, first come, first serve. If you can get back to me, you're it. Write back as quickly as I can, as respectfully, you know, I sign off. And he says, great, can I hear you? And I go, oh my gosh, I don't have anything. And then I remembered that those months of accrued, videos, I just had to quickly skim through, find the best one I could, send it off. Because by this point, I'd taken a break from the oboe after my recital. I'm rusty. I couldn't just, you know, the nerves. So I sent that off, and that's what got me in. So I didn't tell anyone. I called my mom right away, of course. I called my dad. I didn't tell too many people until right before I left, because I couldn't, it felt like it couldn't be true. Mm-hmm. I felt I was being scammed or something, but no, I went, and it's hard to put into words the importance of what that festival was. There were people from all around the world, and so I got to bring what I had in my little backpack of experience to this festival and just unpack it and live off the supplies that I had within it, whatever tools I had available to me that had been equipped by my experiences. Were how I was to survive. And it really was, it at moments, it did feel like that. It was very intense. It was the most intense, most rigorous rehearsal schedule I'd ever experienced up until that point. My wife and I are now married, of course. We've been married going on 5 years now, and we have two girls at home now too. So this festival changed the course of my life musically, and of course in every other respect.
It sounds like it was a very intense experience. Did you feel like you were able to hold your own? Did you feel like you kind of had to draw on from what you had learned at Brock to kind of hold your own?
I think I might have been the youngest, if not one of the youngest people at the festival. It was an opera festival, so there was sort of like everyone was living under the same roof, literally. Like, it was a massive, like, student residence building that we rehearsed in, and we ate in. We all had our dormitories, and we, you know, it was magical. And most people, if I'm not mistaken, were either finished their undergrad or studying their master's, and had much more professional experience than I did. And I didn't take this as anything that was discouraging. In fact, it allowed me to learn from everyone. Understanding that everyone had more experience meant that I could learn something from everyone, a lot from everyone. And I improved very quickly. Over the course of the 3 weeks that it took to rehearse, I had to. I just had to. I was the only oboe player. And there were a few first rehearsals that were pretty rough because they were pretty demanding for where I was at the time. But I really worked at it a lot, because it was all that you could really do other than spend time with your new friends. You know, it was just basically you, your instrument, the internet connection. There was only really Wi-Fi in the lobby, so you couldn't just spend time on your phone or watching Netflix, whatever, which would have been a crime anyway, to waste the opportunity to, you know, anyway, it was like I'd gone back in time before I was so reliant on the internet, and I could really focus on getting as good as I could at the music that I had to play as quickly as possible. So Brock, in terms of what I had and how prepared I was, again, I have to take my hat off to my oboe professor most of all, because of course I was there to play the oboe. And if I had a teacher who would recommend that, oh, do you not feel 100% ready for this? Then don't do it. Don't do it until you feel 100% ready. I would have said no, or I would have never applied in the first place. Colin's approach was always say yes and work for it. Work up to it. You will attain it if you have that goal. And he's been right time and time again. And this was perfect. The proof was in the pudding for this. You know, by the time I was done, these operas that we were playing, we played La Traviata by Verdi, and then two operas by Puccini, Suor Angelica and Gianni Schicchi. And for 3 weeks, we rehearsed 5 days a week. By the end, it was more like 7 days a week. We'd wake up in the morning, start rehearsal at about 9, go until noon, have lunch, be back by 2, rehearse till 6, have dinner, fall asleep, wake up, repeat. And it was very, very demanding compared to the playing schedule that I had before, which was, you know, working my way up to that. And again, I'd prepared a recital up until that point. So that's something that I did definitely benefit from in the Brock program, was the recital. And again, if there are any students that are considering, should I not? Of course you should. If you're nervous about playing, I've got to mention something else that Brock has, which is a masterclass, routine masterclass. A lot of other programs will have a very specific masterclass just to the instrument, which is, of course, wonderful in and of itself. Or maybe they'll only reserve masterclasses for when you know, a soloist comes through to play with the home symphony orchestra.
But, okay, so just as a non-music person, how is a masterclass different from a regular class with your professor?
So a masterclass, typically speaking, say if you have a violin masterclass, you will have a master violin player, air quotes, which would mean a professional soloist usually, okay, come in and specialize in the teaching of the violin. And it's not a one-on-one lesson. That would be, of course, a lesson, but a masterclass is open to other people. You can be a spectator in a masterclass. In fact, that's sort of the defining element of a masterclass, is that it's like an open lesson where basically, and a masterclass can last hours and hours and hours, or it can just be, you know, an hour long or 2 hours long, right? And with no break or whatever. And so usually you'll have, you know, a soloist come or a professional in the field come and listen to a few students. Maybe the student will choose a movement from a sonata that they're working on. And then there's another student that comes up afterwards and is working on a concerto. And you sort of, you know, go through these different folks, and it takes a lot of bravery to get up there as a student, because you're not just playing one-on-one with your teacher. You're playing for someone that, again, maybe is just coming through the city to play the exact concerto you're learning, or, you know, it can be very daunting. And on top of that, you're playing in front of violinists, other violinists, right? So they're looking at you in a way that a normal audience would never be able to look at you, because they are looking, they're analyzing your technique, your musicality, your phrasing, your articulation, everything. They know the piece just as well as you. But, you know, a masterclass is not to tear anyone down. It's, in fact, everyone in the audience is there and understands that it takes immense courage to get up. So it's not, it's, you know, if you can get over all of that, you know, more power to you. You should definitely look for masterclasses wherever you are, whenever they come up. But what makes Brock's masterclasses different is that basically it is a professor who is an instrumentalist in their own right, who has all of the instrumentalists together. So me as an oboe player, I would be in the same group with the violinists and cellists, as well as the clarinet and flute and saxophone and percussion players, all of us together, right? So mm-hmm. sort of a charcuterie board of influence, of instrumentation, of all kinds of pieces and eras. And just like you get exposed to so much music in just a year's time, because it's very easy to get very obsessed, absorbed in the world of just violin playing or just harp playing or whatever it is. But being in this environment, you are exposed to what every other instrument is concerned about, what every other instrument is working on, the technical difficulties. You learn to respect the learning curve, everyone's different learning curve. You see where they're at. You get to watch them week after week, you know, all of your and it's not just first year or second year masterclass. It's for the entire department. Anyone who's playing an instrument that is not piano, which has its own masterclass, or voice, which has its own masterclass, you're in instrumental masterclass, and you're, again, it's very beneficial for your ears, I would say, for your mind, again, to getting it used to listening to all kinds of different classical music and jazz influenced music as well, especially with the saxophones. The experience that I had that leading up to going to Sicily and really being on my own for the first time musically ever, all of the performance opportunities, even the non-oboe ones, I was able to bring my experiences with me to be able to navigate the intricacies of getting used to playing with a whole new group of people, an entirely different repertoire, in a totally different foreign setting. And
one more question about Sicily then. So aside from your wife, obviously, have there been other connections that you made that you have carried forward from that experience?
Right. So the concertmaster, who, for those of you who may not be music majors or who maybe have heard the term in passing, the concertmaster is the first violin, as in just to the left of the conductor. The concertmaster is sort of co-pilot of the orchestra. They help with all the string notations. They really do lead the entire string section. The concertmaster of the Mediterranean Opera Studio Festival Orchestra, when I went, myself and my wife at the time, we had gotten very close with him. He was from Spain, and he was hilarious, and we spent a lot of time together, along with a bassist that that my wife knew at the time too. And so the four of us got to know each other very well. It turns out in Spain, he puts on festivals. He helps put on other festivals. And so that was an immense connection for Ruth and I, because we were able to, the following summer, we were able to go to Spain and to Portugal to play at two different festivals over there, one in Marvão, Portugal, and the other one in a town called Valencia de la Alcántara. In Valencia, I think most people probably know about Valencia or where it might be in Spain. And it was just incredible getting to play with again, different orchestras, different repertoire entirely. And getting to see a little bit more of Europe. I'm still enamored by that time in my life. It still feels too good to be true. It was just incredible. So that was a major connection, that was made. And then I should also mention too, that we didn't just go over for the festivals, but, the summer was spent playing in Portugal and in Spain. And then my wife and I moved to France for a year, where she did a master's degree in creative entrepreneurship and marketing in the creative economies, was the official title. As a violinist, that was indispensable. She now works at the National Arts Center here in Ottawa, where we live now. We live in the Gatineau, Ottawa area. And so that came back around. But that's where I picked up on my French. That's where I really, really... beefed up on my ability to speak and write and communicate in all different ways in French. And I studied at a conservatory over there. So again, those connections helped us leap over the pond and learn a thousand times more, just the, you know, more than just those 6 weeks, just really, really life-changing. And then aside from that, to continue down that same path, there was a piano player that we met in Spain who had studied at the Moscow Conservatory, and she knew about a festival that was happening in Sochi, which is where the Winter Olympics had happened just a few years prior. And they were looking for an oboe player, and she passed my information along. And so I got to play in Russia for a festival that lasted about 2 weeks before heading back to France.
Yeah, so you were just doing French electives, but that gave you enough grounding that when it came time to go to France, you were brave enough to say, yes, let's go.
Yeah, and a lot like, you know, being thrown to the wolves, so to speak, with my musical experience in Sicily. And everything since then, really, you know, the university programs, I was going to say school, but the programs themselves had prepared me to be able to, you know, face the culture with a kind of awareness for what was, you know, for what awaited. So when I was in France, I was teaching a little bit, like private tutoring, English tutoring. And most importantly, I was playing in a community wind ensemble there. And they were fantastic. And I was studying at a conservatory there too. And no one, at no point in time was I speaking English, and you rely on your experience to get you there.
So what led you to being a teacher? What is it about teaching young people music that keeps you motivated? And what's the secret?
Coffee. I say coffee facetiously, but in all honesty, I think you sort of have to like mentally gear yourself up. You have to, you cannot be on a slow gear. You have to be very attentive, because it's like playing, I don't know how to, you have to be bouncing around so fast between this issue, that issue, especially at first. But ideally, every single time you have the same class and the instruments go back out to everyone, it gets a little bit less urgent on everyone's behalf. Everyone feels a little bit more at ease. It's being adaptable. Having some mold, having some preconceived notion of this is how it's got to be, this is how it's going to go. Maybe that works a little bit later on once you've got a lot of experience and you see that there's like this lane that everyone can sort of fit into. But I personally, my philosophy doesn't align with that at all. You think you can fit into that, or, you know, if you want to take it in a totally different direction, all these things are available. But again, just again, my teacher Colin, just the philosophy of remaining open-minded and having your default be yes and not no is just a theme that just keeps cropping up, I find, in every respect.
So in addition to teaching, you've also been very busy with songwriting. And for our listeners, Nick came back to my attention when an email landed in my inbox earlier this summer, or maybe even back in the spring, about a new, I want to say CD, but I'm not sure if that's even the right language anymore to use, a new album, I guess, that that you have been slowly working at putting together. So let's talk about it. Tell me all about this album, how it came to be, what you're trying to do with it, and where people can find it.
Absolutely. So it unfortunately doesn't exist in CD format yet, but I'm working on it just for you, okay?
Just for us old people.
but I would love to get an album, like a vinyl pressing of it too, eventually. Right now, it's streaming anywhere. I always say anywhere you listen to your music, you'll find it there. And so it's basically just a collection of 9 songs that some of which have been sitting on for a while, some of which are very new and have been written during my recent adventures and reflect all of it. It's sort of a it's a combination of different things. And there, you know, when I wanted to record this album, I should mention that I've been writing songs way longer than I've been playing oboe. way, way longer. It's been something that I've been doing since I was very, very young. I remember I used to write songs with a friend of mine in middle school. I was in grade 8, and we'd call each other over the phone, like the landline before anyone had cell phone. And I'd say, listen, Alex, check this out. Listen. And then we'd play it for each other. And, oh, how would this go with this? You know, and I've been doing this for a long, or rather I've been wanting to record for a long time. I remember every year in university telling myself, this is the summer. I've got all the free time. I can do it this summer. I can do it. And it just never came to be for one reason or another. And so finally,
I think it was those trips to Sicily in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I feel like that might have gotten
very worthwhile. Very worth. That's a very good reason to postpone a project.
Totally. And so now, you know, I feel as though things in my personal and professional life are established enough now that I can pursue this and finally get it out. And thankfully, it's come to be. So the 9 songs are the theme of the album. The overarching idea was that I wanted to sort of reintroduce myself, because up until now, again, most of my professional life as a musician has been as a freelance oboist or as a guitar player or a session player for bands that needed someone to sit in for some gigs or to play on a patio somewhere and do some covers, which, you know, is great and all, but it wasn't always really what my heart was into, the latter, not the former. I always loved the oboe playing. But finally, I wanted to sort of say, okay, this is what I really, really want to do. This is what I have to get off my chest. A lot of these songs are very personal. They can be autobiographical or they can just be observational. But the 9 songs, what they all have in common is I sat down with the list of songs that I have available. I have at least another 2 albums ready to record, but I haven't recorded them yet. I have a wealth of songs, thankfully. But I sat down and thought to myself, what are the songs where I can play all the instruments myself? I thought to myself, each one of these songs are unique. They all have their own genre, even. They span different genres. But the continuity of the album is that I wanted to play all the instruments myself. And my theory was that there would be a feeling that would sort of emanate from the tracks, from the feeling of the tracks, that that would have a continuity throughout them. And it would be something sort of subliminal in the sense that it feels like it's always the same person, because it is. I played all the like the main tracks on all of the songs. The producer is also a Brock Music graduate. His name is Fergus Gundy, and he added you know, the keyboards and he mixed things beautifully. His voice is found on the record too, percussion. Lots of different stuff sort of conclude the album and make it what it came to be. So the 9 songs are sort of a testament to what my life has been so far. And again, a reintroduction to, okay, I'm not just what you thought I was. I'd like to let you know that I have other things to say. I actually have something to say. And I wanted to reintroduce myself.
And the album is called Without Love.
The last track is called Without Love. The album is called World in Vain.
World in Vain. Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And we can find this on YouTube, Spotify.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned this delay in the project, and it's kind of funny. I was just having this conversation with somebody else, how sometimes you try to do something and it doesn't go forward, and then a year or two later, everything falls into place for you. Did you find that kind of that period of percolation or maturation of your ideas, did that benefit the album in the end? Do you think it would have been a very different album if you had done it in university when you initially had that idea and desire to do it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I realized I had to wait. You know, it came to be for a specific reason at a specific time. If I had done it earlier, I'm sure it would have been good, but it would have been very different. And It would have been the best I could do. That's all, you know, and I think a lot of people struggle, and I think I struggled with it too at the time. You're only as ready as you can be at any given time. And it's for any artistic endeavor. If you're worried about, oh, this isn't good enough, that's not where it should be. Yes, fair enough, but do the best you can. It's better to do it as best you can. And maybe it's not exactly, you know, what you have in your head just yet. It's better that it exists than it never sees the light of day.
That's beautiful. Just as you were speaking, I was just thinking about my own experience with podcasting and how, you know, I look back when I started podcasting and compared to what I do and how I do approach it and whatnot now. And I suppose music is a little bit similar in that you have to put it out there for it to get better. Like, it's a bit of a public experimentation.
Right. Exactly. And now I realize that's exactly what it is. It's not anything if it's just for you, if it's just in your own head, you know, it is, it can console, it can excite, if it's only for you at the moment, right? A project is very exciting, as a prospect. But once you've actually done everything to make it come true and then it actually is out there, you know, you're open to all kinds of new things that you were never open to before. And it is actually, I found it very freeing because it's out, it's done. I did it. I don't have to worry about, will I ever do it? It's done. And if I've done it once, I can do it again. So, I will absolutely record another album in due time. It's just finished now, so I'm in no rush to head back to get that, you know, anything new done just yet. But again, it's also like there might be someone who needs to hear it, you know, like whatever your song is about, you know, the person that needs to hear the message or the person that really, really loves the song and really feels it, you know, they don't care that you haven't got that perfect fill there yet, or they don't, you know, they're not going to, in fact, they might enjoy how quirky the little mistake was, if it's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it's funny. It's a lot like teaching too, because it's sort of like in your endeavor to get as good as you possibly can, studying music or any form of art, you it's sort of like you're scaling a mountain, right? You stop, you set up camp, you start the next day, and sometimes, you know, you have to find another way around. But anyway, you make your way up to a certain height, and then to ask to teach from the beginning, it's sort of like turning around and telling someone how you got that high up. And maybe you don't remember exactly how you got over this particular difficult spot, or, you know, it's really taxing. But, you know, at the end of the day, most people are not musicians. The vast majority of your listeners will not be musicians. Even if all your friends are musicians and the people you're making music with are musicians, you sort of have to always be in touch with, what does this sound like if I don't know anything about what I've put into doing this, which is like absurd, because you put so much effort into the construction of it, into the architecture of it, into the meaning of it for you. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm going too far down or far in, but I think a lot of writers of any kind or artists of any kind, they're very intentional and they use, again, all that experience. But at the end of the day, you're making it for people who don't have any experience. So you have to sort of be in touch with that almost childlike misunderstanding of your intentions.
That's really interesting. And I think that's good advice maybe for any kind of creative work, whether it's, you know, artistic or performance or writing or whatever it is, that when we're doing something creative and putting ourselves out there and when we're training in it, I think sometimes we can maybe have a tendency to be really self-critical of what we're doing, but to be able to kind of step back and to see it as our audience, whoever that audience is, to see it or hear it as that audience.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So as an artist, as a musical artist, what kind of, like, how do you deal with criticism? Because you're performing, you're sharing creativity, you're sharing something very personal, and then you're getting feedback from people you admire, from professors, from audience, maybe from newspaper critics, you know, whoever, from yourself maybe as well. How do you kind of balance that and keep that creative momentum going forward while dealing sometimes perhaps with negative feedback or criticism or perspectives on your work that aren't quite what you wanted to hear?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. That's a very important question too. I would also lump in disappointment, a silent disappointment. You know, if you expect your song to reach a certain audience, or you're expecting that it's going to lead you to this, you know, XYZ, whatever it may be, whatever you have in your mind, and it doesn't automatically do that, that it, you know, it can also be kind of souring, you know. But I would say that the most important thing is to try to keep yourself in check and in tune with your own intentions, and the reminding yourself of what your best is, and being honest with yourself about that. If you're being false, if you feel like you're pretending, or you're writing for someone or something, some idea that you have of, oh, if I say this, it'll come off like that. You know, being too self-critical is not a good thing, but at the same time, it's also absolutely essential to keep yourself in check. But I suppose it's about being aware of the voice that's telling you, this feels right, this feels good. Because if it feels right and it feels good to you, before you put it out to the world, you know that it's coming from an honest place, and that any criticism of it, it transcends personal, because you're not, it felt right. And maybe there's no explanation for that. You can't explain why you thought that it should go like this, or it should go like that. It is what it is. And you did the best you could. And if anyone doesn't like it, if it's not of their taste, it's absurd to expect everyone to like it. You know, you can take what you can from it. You know, if it's an honest criticism and it's fair, then, you know, you can listen to it and go, ah, okay, I see that maybe this this lyric here was, you know, kind of, I don't know what you could say about it, or, you know, maybe this is too repetitive, or this is too that. I guess what you have to do is to be aware of your decision making and be comfortable with it, right? Like, you know what your options are, and then proceed.
So what I'm hearing in what you're saying really is genuine authenticity and a personal integrity.
Yeah, being as corny as it is, being true to oneself. Like, and I don't want to say that, because it's sort of, you know, when you hear something often enough, it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, and the word authenticity is kind of one of those words, because we hear it so much in social media contexts and whatnot that it starts to kind of lose its meaning.
Yeah, it's potency for sure. So I'm trying to sort of like walk around the point and try to get to the heart of it that way, and just saying that if it feels as right as it can to you, negative criticism is someone's opinion, which is entirely valid, but you did what felt right, and that's all you can do. How can you possibly change what you felt was right? You know, if you know, and also the cool thing about it is it's not like a form of art that is just stagnant, right? Like the recording, yes, but the good news is I can always, if I absolutely cannot stand a recording, I can just take it down, you know. But I personally don't believe in doing that sort of thing, because it documents a moment in time, a moment in your life. Any musician that puts something up is documenting that moment in time. Whatever it represents is, it's encapsulated in the music. And So I don't believe in taking it down necessarily, but you know, and I don't think I will ever do that. In fact, I don't know why I mentioned it, but I'm just saying it's an option. But the other option is too that, you know, every time I perform the song, I can do it differently. You know, I don't ever want to play the same thing exactly the same twice, you know. And that's the fun of it, is that, you know, if I want to change this part, I can. You know, it's still putty in my hands. It's still music. It's still free. And I can still, you know, change it according to what I feel is right then. You know, I did it so it felt right at the time. I did the best I could. And maybe it changes, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it always feels right to do it that way, you know? And I often find people are, if really people are actually in the state of mind to accept something new, such as a new song that they've never heard before, oftentimes it's an experience that people can walk away from and feel happy that they stayed, happy that they listened, happy that they, you know, they took the time to hear you out. And that's really what they're doing, is they're hearing you out because you have to say something. And that means the world, really, because people's time, people's attention is so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of time, I'm going to thank you for your time. I really appreciate the honesty and the passion that you have shared with us today, and your words of wisdom as well. You've given me things to think about, and I am very excited to see what happens for you next. Certainly get in touch when the next album comes out, and I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Likewise, Allison.
Thank you for listening to Forward. Find our footnotes, links to more information, transcripts, and past episodes on our website, brocku.ca/humanities. We love to hear from our listeners, so join us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @brockhumanities. Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. Forward is hosted and produced by Allison Innes for the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Sound editing is by Serena Atella, and theme music is by Khaled Imam. This podcast is financially supported by the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University.